NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, farmers say the federal funding freeze is halting growth and derailing their planning for the year, and young farmers are particularly hard hit. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke to some younger farmers in the region to understand what's at stake and how they're struggling to make critical decisions this spring as billions of dollars in promised federal payments remain frozen by the Trump administration. As libraries across the country face unprecedented challenges, the American Library Association has launched a new initiative to ensure its future, the Show Up for Our Libraries campaign. We speak to the executive director of Wayne County Libraries to understand how it seeks to protect the core values of libraries, access to free information, plus the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra's upcoming concert for Women's History Month. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Sirens sounded around Tel Aviv today. They were followed by a series of explosions. The Israeli military said projectiles were fired from southern Gaza and were either intercepted or fell in, quote, open areas. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Tel Aviv. Hamas later claimed responsibility.
It was the first military response by Hamas since Israel broke the ceasefire in Gaza earlier this week, with a series of airstrikes that killed more than 400 Palestinians, including many children, and wounded hundreds more. Israel then launched a ground invasion into Gaza and has continued with airstrikes, especially in the north, killing dozens more. On the militant group's Telegram channel, Hamas said it fired rockets at Tel Aviv in response for Israel's strikes and the killing of civilians. Earlier this morning, sirens also sounded throughout much of central Israel as the Iran-backed Houthis fired a missile from Yemen. The group said the target was Ben Gurion Airport. Israel says it was intercepted before crossing into Israeli territory. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has told the media President Trump was attentive during their phone call yesterday. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Zelensky told reporters he had a wide-ranging talk with President Trump about all the issues facing Ukraine, the destruction of power plants and civilian infrastructure, the kidnapped children, the bombed churches, and lost historical identity. He also said Russian President Vladimir Putin believes he's in a strong position on the battlefield, so doesn't really want to end the war now.
Зробити pressing.
We see him amassing troops to put pressure on us, said Zelensky, scaring people with drones and missiles, all to give the Russians better conditions for ending the war. Zelensky said Ukraine needs more air defense while it waits for the ceasefire. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
NPR has learned President Trump is poised to sign an executive action today. It directs the U.S. Secretary of Education to move toward closing the Department of Education and giving oversight to the states. This move has been expected for weeks. About half of the Education Department's staff has already been told they're being laid off. The American Federation of Teachers is suing the U.S. Education Department. The union says the Trump administration has improperly shut down access to a program. This program lets students apply for affordable repayment plans for student loans. A federal jury in Minnesota has convicted two people in a multi-million dollar fraud scheme. Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik reports this is in connection with a pandemic-era federal nutrition program.
Jurors found Amy Bach, the founder of the nonprofit Feeding Our Future, and former restaurant owner Salim Saeed guilty in the $250 million scheme. Prosecutors say the two exploited pandemic-era rule changes in federal child nutrition programs and submitted thousands of phony meal reimbursement claims. The two are among 70 people who've been charged since 2022.
Matt Sepik reporting. You're listening to NPR. The head of the passenger railroad Amtrak is resigning. Stephen Gardner has led Amtrak for 3 years. He's leaving after billionaire Elon Musk, who's also the head of Doge, called to privatize Amtrak. California highway officials say a major entrance to Yosemite National Park is closed. Heavy rain triggered a rock slide. The highway is thickly covered with debris. California officials don't know when they'll be able to clear the road. Yosemite is more than 100 miles east of San Francisco. A new study out today makes the case that most art museums should be free to the public. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the study analyzes the operating costs and visitor numbers of more than 150 U.S. museums.
High entry fees are a major reason why people don't go to art museums. The study's findings show that making museums free actually lowers the cost per visitor, especially for small and mid-sized museums. Stephen Riley is the founding director of ReMuseum, the think tank behind the report.
Museums are not businesses. They're philanthropic institutions providing a public good for people.
Riley says choosing to get rid of entry fees doesn't make sense for every museum, and the study does not address how art institutions might recoup the lost revenue if they choose to go free. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
An annual report finds that, once again, the happiest country in the world is Finland. The University of Oxford has released its World Happiness Report. It examined kindness and how people care for one another. The U.S. fell one rung to 24th place on the World Happiness Report. The UN says today is the International Day of Happiness. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, as we've been reporting, federal funding freezes have impacted local farmers, but young farmers say they face unique challenges. For young and beginner farmers, federal funding is critical as they shore up their first few years of production. That's money farmers were planning to use to do things like put up foundational fencing, pay farm workers, or build their first hay tunnel. Some farmers are saying these are projects they've already paid into and were waiting for reimbursement when the federal funding freeze took hold. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke to some young farmers in the region to understand what's at stake and how they're responding to these freezes.
Oh. How's it going?
That's the sound of Iris Van Gillingham's sheep. No, she doesn't just keep them around because they're fuzzy and cute. The Icelandic and Shetland sheep help graze 150 acres of farmland during the summertime.
So this is Fiddlehead. She's a descendant of some of the original flock that my mom got 30 years ago.
Wow. In 2022, Iris started Gale Roots Community Farm in Livingston Manor to bring agricultural education and food access to Sullivan County. It's a place with so much purpose. They offer a pay-what-you-can farm stand at farmers markets, local students help prep the soil for production, and they offer a residency program for fiber artists who utilize the farm's plants and sheep wool. As community needs change, Iris is open to the farm evolving.
We're still building out infrastructure and developing our programming as we grow sustainably and as part of the community. You know, this farm was created kind of as a love letter to the community. So what it becomes is also part of what the community needs as times change.
And times have certainly changed for farmers, especially young farmers. In January, the Trump administration announced sweeping freezes on federal loans and grants, including U.S. Department of Agriculture funding. Some of those frozen funds are tied to former President Joe Biden's 2022 Inflation Act, which invested more than $20 billion for agricultural and climate-smart programs over 10 years. Earlier this month, the USDA also slashed $1 billion for schools and food banks to buy food from local farmers. These cuts are happening while young farmers are also bracing for higher costs due to President Donald Trump's retaliatory tariffs. Here is President Trump during the Congressional Joint Session in March, promising these actions are what's best for farmers.
Our new trade policy will also be great for the American farmer. I love the farmer. Yes! Who will now be selling into our home market, the USA, because nobody is going to be able to compete with you.
Iris at Gale Roots says the freeze has not only impacted her, but the entire agriculture industry.
The federal funding freeze has been just a huge cyclone through agriculture, especially this time of year, because farmers are planning for their next season. And some farmers were still waiting on reimbursements from the previous season. And one of the things about our food system in the United States is that it is very much held up by federal funding.
Iris was expecting to receive $10,000 for her participation in Cornell Cooperative Extension's Beginning Farmer Mentorship Program. Funding Iris had been nominated and applied for has also been slashed, a $75,000 grant from Fordham University focused on expanding food access in Livingston Manor. This would have helped with irrigation and landscape infrastructure, she said her farm needed.
What you're looking at is one of our fields that there's two aspects that we were hoping to get funding for this year, and we'll see what happens. But this field right here is extremely wet, and so we were looking at getting some funding to help create an irrigation pond and drain some of this field so that we can utilize more of it for sheep pasture, as well as be able to irrigate the upper acre garden of veggies there. And if you see behind that tree, it's a little bit greener because we actually have a winter rye cover crop down that's just starting to show a little bit different than the other grass colors. And that is what we were planning to use, or what we were planning to use some of the Beginning Farmer Mentorship Program funding for, which was to fence that all in, so that we could have deer fencing and keep the deer out of the vegetables.
Yeah. Iris says, we have yet to fully understand the consequences these freezes will have on our nation's food supply.
Our food system is kind of being rocked, and that's nationally. It's big ag, small family farms, ranches, whatever it might be. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago, and we were at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition meeting, and people there from Iowa to North Dakota to the Catskills were talking about, here's what's happening. Our farmers are stressed. We have so much planning that has to go into this next year to make sure that farmers can get food in the ground to feed the country. And all of a sudden, they're concerned whether they're actually going to, you know, get the money that they're owed, or if they're going to have money for their product come harvest season. So it's really a crazy time.
Chris Nicol and Brenda Gonzalez, co-founders of Finca Seremos Farm, are local farmers also navigating these uncertain times. They participated in Cornell's Beginning Farmer Mentorship Program in 2024, and their final check was supposed to come in this year, but they have yet to receive those funds due to the federal freeze. Chris says they're not alone. Over the last few weeks, Chris has been collecting stories for the Young Farmers Coalition from farmers across New York who were expecting federal funding, anywhere from $2,000 to $50,000 to more than $2.1 million.
They really span the gamut. I mean, these are young farmers in their first few years of production, like us at Finca Seremos. They are farmers who've been in the business for 20-plus years. And the more mature farmers, it's really big grants that they were counting on to be able to expand production. In many cases, think about processing facilities for value-added products. Think about infrastructure on farm, like fencing, like irrigation. These are large capital investments in the long-term health of their businesses. And the way the federal government works is similar to the state, where these are all reimbursement grants. And so farmers in many cases are 20, 30, 50% paid into these projects already, if not 100%. And they're left holding the bag because the feds are not honoring the contracts that they've actually signed. So in many cases, we're talking about obligated payments here, right? We're talking about payments that are obligated to these farmers by a contract. And so it's kind of wild to think about the federal government reneging on all of these contracts.
On top of the freeze, Chris and Brenda continue to face a challenge all too common for beginner farmers.
We're renters. We don't own our land. And a lot of the USDA programming that benefits even small farmers hinges on more permanent land access.
Chris and Brenda were originally renting an acre of land in Beacon, but recently moved to a larger farm where they rent 3 acres in Calicoon Center. Chris says not owning their land has made it even more challenging to access funds they were already awarded from a USDA specialty crops grant.
And if you got your application in and it was all smooth, you got the money before the freeze. But our application got tied up again because our land access shifted.
Hmm.
And so we're currently, as we speak, I think, typing out an email to USDA to inquire about whether those funds have been unfrozen yet.
Data from the Young Farmers Coalition shows that more than half of young farmers named finding affordable land to buy as very or extremely challenging.
It is the number one issue facing young farmers in this country. Land access is incredibly challenging on a number of fronts, especially for folks who are socioeconomically disadvantaged, who are minorities. You know, we're not supposed to talk about DEI anymore, but the reality is that especially Black farmers have had their land stolen over generations, to say nothing of the settler colonialism and in theft of indigenous lands on which this country is founded. So land access is far and away the biggest issue facing young farmers, both in this region, in the Catskills and in the Hudson Valley, where land is so valuable because of its proximity to New York City. But nationally, the National Young Farmers Coalition did a survey in 2022, and it was the standout issue then, and it remains so now. And so, you know, there are more and more federal programs trying to address some of these issues, and those are some of the programs getting cut.
Both Chris and Iris say that regionalizing our food economy is essential to making sure New York farmers can withstand the current federal funding halts.
Our food system was not perfect in the beginning, in the first place, and I think the food system has been propped up and kind of patched over with Band-Aids a lot. We need to be looking more at local and regionalized food systems, period. Like, we're dealing with a time where the cost of food is so high, the cost of transportation is so high, and especially in the Catskills, where we are a rural area and we do actually have a lot of producers here, like, how can we engage more with our local producers and agricultural community?
But efforts to invest in regionalizing our economy, well, that hinges on federal funding.
Our food economy is so fragile as it is, and the efforts that we're collectively, us smaller and local and regional farmers, are trying to make to shore up that fragility hinge on our access to these federal grants because of the way the system works. And
right.
So you deny us that money, you set us back 10, 20 years in these efforts to really bolster the stability and security and sovereignty of our food economy.
For now, Chris says that organizing the ag sector is key. They said everyone can play a role in pushing back against these funding freezes, from USDA government workers to farmers in the Hudson Valley and the Catskills.
We are trying to knit together all of these actors who have a stake in this issue so that we can flex that power and get some of this funding back online and get our federal workers back in their jobs and protected.
In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And thanks to Kim for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, show up for our libraries, a new initiative to support free access to information, reading, and all that libraries provide. We'll speak to the Wayne County Library Director to learn more about it next. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, the growing cozy relationship between the United States and El Salvador. We dive into Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's mano dura, or hard hand approach to crime, and his controversial offer to incarcerate American citizens. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She'll talk to host Anna Malaika Tubbs about her new book, Dream Count. It's her first novel since 2013, when she published Americana to critical acclaim. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The American Library Association has launched Show Up for Our Libraries, a campaign to harness the collective power of library advocates and supporters to influence elected leaders and policymakers. Tracy Schwartz is the Wayne County Library Director, and in Wayne County, there are seven, count them, seven member libraries located in Honesdale, Hawley, Hamlin, Newfoundland, Bethany, Lakewood, and Pleasant Mount. Tracy is going to tell us more about how the community can get involved with that campaign and also more about all of the library's essential services. Tracy, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me today. It's just really exciting to be here because there's so much going on at all seven of our very vibrant libraries.
Well, and you guys are doing such a great job in Wayne County, and all of our libraries in the region do such a great job supporting everybody in the community. Let's talk a little bit more about this Show Up for Our Libraries campaign. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So it's basically just taking an opportunity to advocate for all of the great things that libraries have been doing for generations, because Americans cherish their and rely on their libraries. They're hearts of the communities. They provide essential services and foster literacy and learning and innovation. So this is an opportunity for people to capture those stories. How has the library impacted your life and your community? And we're just asking people to reach out to their local officials, their state officials, their federal officials, and tell them that libraries are important to you.
I will tell you my little story. As you mentioned stories, I was in elementary school, got to assist in the library. So I have an affection for the Dewey Decimal System from a young age. Why do you think it's important for folks to take this proactive approach for libraries?
Well, you know, with everything that's been going on lately, public libraries in Pennsylvania don't receive direct federal funding, but the implications of what could happen if the, you know, if IMLS, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, is cut, may have some effects down the line. So what we need to do is make sure that people are aware of all of the things that libraries do in their communities, like summer reading programs and internet access, employment assistance, Braille and talking books for people with visual impairments, homework and research, and veterans telehealth, and all of the different things going on in libraries that are super important that we want to protect. And to do that, we need funding, and we need to have people support us and know how important we are, particularly in rural communities.
The Institute of Museum and Library Services that you mentioned is an independent agency of the federal government, but President Trump a few days ago signed an executive order to eliminate that agency that funds museums and libraries. And as you mentioned, you don't receive it directly, but that agency sends that through to the states, which then in Pennsylvania distributes to libraries like yours in Wayne County. Is that right?
Right. So it could have an impact on our access to online databases and interlibrary loans and all of the people who work at the Office of Commonwealth Libraries who support us. So it basically, it's going to have that ripple effect. Well, so we need to shore up what's happening in our libraries. And as you know, in Wayne County, our libraries are funded about 30% from our local Wayne County commissioners, 20% from the state, and then the rest we're all raising through the support of donors and people like yourself who love libraries. So that's like trying to figure out 50% of your budget every year as a we hope so.
Well, and that has to be one of the challenges you faced even prior to this threat of, you know, the funding possibly going away. So what are some of the challenges that you face, especially with everything that's sort of changing right now?
Right. Well, and honestly, because PA libraries are all a little bit squirrely in how they're funded because it's not all the same across the board. So our libraries are really struggling a lot with the fact that, you know, there's a lot of nonprofits who are all in the same boat, and we all are looking to the same pool of people to help us. And we have a really generous business community and really generous private donors, but after a while, you can't continue at the same rate with the same level of funding when everything around you is going up.
Yeah. You used the technical term squirrely, so I want to ask you a little bit more about that. Because in Pennsylvania, well, you're right, it's structured a little differently. Tell me about how that works for you guys and what the role of the Wayne Library Alliance is as well, and how that's different from a main library in the branches.
Yes. So every library is set up differently, and everyone always assumes, because that's the way some of us were brought up, that there's a main library and branches. And in Wayne County, that's not the way it works. We are tied together by an alliance, the Wayne Library Alliance, with 7 member libraries. So they are all 7 individual 501c3 nonprofits. They all have their own boards. They all have their own collections and the way they handle things. But the WLA ties them together so that we can receive state and local government funding, and helps us out with things like having a driver that takes – I had a great picture on my Facebook page the other day about the 15 bins of books that were passing through the library in Honesdale to get to all of the other libraries. And people don't realize we have something like 15 to 30 bins almost every week of things coming in that people have requested from other libraries. So one of the services the WLA is able to provide with some of their funding is a delivery driver to go back and forth with those bins.
Well, which is a great thing in a rural area to have. And that's part of your resource sharing that you have among the libraries as well. Tell us a little bit more about that, the resource sharing. So
the resource sharing is cool because it opens up a lot more funding and availability of materials, because we all use the same circulation system. So that place where you go in and you check your books in and out, we have 5 counties all on the same system, so we can share books and materials back and forth. And that saves on the cost of having to request things from other libraries in the state that previously had to be mailed through the mail system to get to us, which was costly. So it's opened up a whole new world of what our readers and our watchers and our information seekers in Wayne County have access to.
And how do the books and materials get around? Is that driver that's taking that all around then?
No. So part of that funding comes from our district center, which is in Scranton, and they have a delivery driver that you'll see out in the road with giant books on the side of the great big truck that he drives, and he goes between all 5 of our northeast counties.
Do we know the names of these drivers? We need to acknowledge them.
Oh my gosh, we just got a new driver. That's terrible.
Okay. Well, if you see them out on the road, Wayne County people, say hi and thank you for all the work that they're doing.
Well, our driver right here in Wayne County is Bill.
Bill
used to be the library director in Pleasant Mount. So he loves those books and makes sure that everything gets through and is really well taken care of, because he's a library guy.
Big thanks to Bill. Big shout out to Bill. I want to just circle back to the, you know, showing up for your library. As we talk about all of these services, and you get down to the granular level of someone just actually getting a book and delivering it to you. I mean, that's part of this whole idea of libraries, providing free access to information. Let's talk a little bit about why it's so crucial and why people need to support it.
Well, so what's more exciting than being a kid who walks into the library and gets a library card and then has this whole door opened and can jump in and try all of these different books and live all of these different lives and go on adventures that, you know, you can't do as a grounded human? And the same thing goes for adults. I mean, is there anything more joyful than walking into a room full of books and getting to go somewhere that you may never have access to? So we have to be here so that lots and lots of people can have access to whatever information makes them happy. And that's kind of a nice segue into in every April there is a National Library Week, and it honors all that libraries do. And this year's theme is called Drawn to Libraries. So I love that whatever draws you into the library has something for everyone. And that is what we have to protect, that you can walk in our doors and have access to computers and books and adventures. And in some cases, we have puzzles or, you know, things that you can check out to bake cakes. There are a lot of bizarre things that libraries are checking out now because they're here to serve community needs.
And you are, you know, providing these needs as technology develops, resources develop, as communities grow. Are you seeing more engagement in communities in Wayne County with the libraries?
Absolutely, because we're also here in Wayne County, too. We do a lot of partnering. So we partner with Workforce Alliance, and they send us over a computer teacher whose name is Alexa, and that always makes me laugh. Because people think I'm joking. I'm like, sign up for a computer course with Alexa. And they're like, no, I want a real person. And I'm like, but she is a real person. So
everybody who's listening to this right now who has one of those smart devices with that name is experiencing technical difficulties, I'm sure. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Oops. Sorry.
Sorry.
She's from Workforce Alliance, and she comes every Thursday to the library and on a variety of schedules to some of our other libraries in Wayne County to help with digital literacy, because there are so many people who are sort of being forced to go online and learn how to do things that before you could just fill out a piece of paper for. So we partner with them to help our workforce grow stronger, and that makes our whole community grow. Mm. We partner with a ton of different people, and we have all sorts of buy-in with the school districts and with just really great relationships with local businesses who, you know, put out jars on their counter and say, hey, can you help out the library? They're our nonprofit of the month. So there's a lot of love for what we do here, but there's also a lot of confusion over, how can I get a library card? What happens at the library? And you don't really think about it if you're somebody who either doesn't need free books or access to things or doesn't need to learn how to use computer resources, but you still value the fact that these are here for people. It's a place for senior citizens to come and get together. We have a group of knitters, and we have people playing canasta, and then we have kids coming in and doing all sorts of Lego clubs and just amazing things happening, homeschoolers. So you don't really realize what a community hub these libraries are, particularly, like I said, in rural counties.
Yeah, they're kind of the community center, if you will. And I think, as you said, some people might take them for granted if they don't themselves use them. But I think that there are people that understand the importance and need for them. If, you know, for those folks, and even for folks who may not be aware and learning more as we talk about what libraries do beyond lending books, what do you say to them to convince them how essential they are and how they can get involved to show up for libraries?
Well, the other thing is, even if you aren't aware, you have friends and families and neighbors and people that you work with who might need our resources. And a lot of people aren't aware that we have things like ebooks and e-resources that you can access for free with your library card. So say you're somebody who loves crafting. We have something called Creative Bug that you can go on and download all sorts of different videos and learn how to paint or knit or sew. We have something called A to Z Foods that you need a last minute recipe, hop on with your library card for free and you can explore not only the nation, but the world of food recipes. Then the Libby app, which has access to audiobooks and ebooks that you can download. So we always refer to that part of it as, if you can't make it to the library building, we're still open 24/7 because you have access to Libby. And then Hoopla, which also has e and audiobooks, but then has TV, movies, master classes, and there's one other thing, music. So we're here physically in the building, but then we're open 24/7 for things that people need who can't get to the building. So you never know when you're going to need us, even if it's just for tax forms.
That's right. And the good to know that you have all of those things and more. And let's remind folks where they can get more information about the Wayne Library Alliance and the Wayne County Public Library.
So if you go to our website, which is shared at the beginning, you go to waynelibraries.org, and that's going to take you to the Wayne Library Alliance's homepage. But then there's a drop-down of locations where you can click on each one of the different libraries and find out what's going on at their library, because they each have, several of them have their own websites that kind of link up. And we have Facebook pages and all sorts of other things that you can go to find out, you know, what's coming up, what presentations are coming up, and are there some fundraisers you can get involved in. There's it's the sort of the landing page, and it tells you how to sign up for a library card and how to donate and what e-resources we have. Yeah. So it's all right there at your fingertips.
That's Tracy Schwartz. She is the Wayne County Public Library Director. Again, there's more information at waynelibraries.org. And if you want to show up for libraries and share your story and advocate for libraries, you can go to the American Library Association's website, ala.org. Before we go, Tracy, you mentioned the library card. You guys still actually have a physical library card? And how can we get one?
Yeah, we absolutely do. Well, actually, you can start it out at home if you want to by filling in the online form, which is on the website, or you can just pop into any of your 7 libraries and they will help you through the process. Basically, you just need to bring a photo ID or a piece of mail that says that you live in Pennsylvania so that you have access to a free library card. And if you live outside the area, you can get a library card in Pennsylvania. You just have to pay a small fee.
And that helps support the library.
It does.
Well, thank you again, Tracy, for telling us all about what you guys are doing and how we can support our libraries. And as I mentioned, I'm a big library supporter, having helped out my elementary school. I would never have discovered Misty of Chincoteague without it. So thank you.
Well, and I thank you for still, doing the shout out for the Dewey Decimal System, because I know it's the bane of some people's existence, but it helps us find things.
It's essential. So,
yes, thank you. Just like libraries. And thank you so much. And we hope to see everybody from April 6th to 12th, if not sooner, for National Library Week.
All right, Tracy. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
We'll take a break and back with more Radio Chatskill after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In Orange County, Middletown Mayor Joseph DeStefano used his State of the City address Tuesday to tout infrastructure projects and reaffirm his support for the city's immigrant community. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King reports.
As the Trump administration works to ramp up deportations nationwide, DeStefano, a Democrat, says he's committed to supporting Middletown's immigrant residents.
Today I sit here to reaffirm a simple yet powerful truth. Our city is stronger, more vibrant, and more prosperous because of our immigrant communities. We will not turn our backs on the hardworking men, women, and children who call this place their home.
Nearly 40% of Middletown's residents identify as Hispanic or Latino, according to the city. Rumors of ICE enforcement have swirled in the Hudson Valley in recent months, with confirmed sightings in Kingston. DeStefano says he agrees that undocumented felons should be deported, and that the city will continue enforcing and cooperating with ICE on criminal warrants. Administrative warrants, however, will be enforced only in rare cases. Financially, DeStefano says the city is in good shape. He says the fund balance sits at roughly $15.5 million, and for the past 12 years, they've been able to keep tax levies at or below the state property tax cap. Crime, meanwhile, he says has gone down, although he did criticize New York's bail reform laws.
Studies and reports suggest a correlation between bail reform and certain crime increases, particularly in offenses like robbery and grand larceny. In 2024, we saw 24 offenders arrested more than five times in our city alone. Each one arrested more than five times just in the city of Middletown. This is unacceptable to our community and should be unacceptable to the state legislature, and it must change.
Meantime, DeStefano says Middletown is making progress on efforts to renovate the former federal courthouse on South Street. DeStefano says the city needs to renovate the site, which has sat vacant since 2014, in order to comply with a state mandate to expand its courts. He says the state initially wanted the city to cover all of the costs, which total around $9 million. But after years of debate, the city now only has to pay $3 million.
We will now expand the police department, moving their basement offices into the former courthouse. The renovation has begun on South Street, and we hope the courthouse project will be complete in 2026.
DeStefano says the new courthouse will be named after late New York State Supreme Court Judge Angelo Ingrassia, a Middletown resident who died in 2013. The city is also working on sidewalk improvements, new splash pads, and a number of housing initiatives. DeStefano says the Middletown Housing Authority is constructing an additional 100 affordable rental units, and a 17th home is set to be constructed this year as part of the city's Homeownership Opportunities Program, which renovates vacant, city-owned properties for homeownership. Common Council President J. Miguel Rodriguez says he's especially pleased by the city's efforts to ramp up bus service to New York City after the COVID-19 pandemic. Middletown also announced plans last year to renovate the old Ontario and Western train station in order to relocate its Head Start child care programs.
That's stuff that is in the heart of our city. So getting a hub for transportation is great. Doing the O&W train station and redoing it is like the biggest eyesore coming into our city. And it's, you know, we're spending millions and millions of dollars on it and getting grant monies. So, I think that's really good.
DeStefano, who is running for re-election this year, acknowledged in his speech that federal funding for Head Start programs and for many of the projects outlined in his 90-minute speech is up in the air as the federal government looks to cut spending nationwide. However, he says Middletown will move forward with what it can.
Keep in mind that this city isn't just where I serve. It's where I grew up. I know so many of you. You know me. Every street, every neighborhood, every person here is part of the story, and together we are writing the next chapter of our city's great future.
Reporting for WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau on the campus of Vassar College, I'm Jesse King.
And thanks to the New York Public News Network for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra celebrating Women's History Month. We'll have more after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
This Week in This American Life.
Excuse me. Sorry to bother you, but I just have to tell you, I love your voice. Excuse me. I'm sorry to bother you, but I just have to tell you, I love your... Excuse me.
The episode that we did on stage and beamed into movie theaters everywhere, Tig Notaro and others, this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
On the next This Old House Radio Hour, American Pickers Mike Wolf shares his story of renovating a 100-year-old general store.
I'm a romantic, and I think about when I look out the window when I'm looking at the Mississippi River, that's the same exact view that someone had from 1860.
And we answer all your home improvement questions. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from 8 p.m., American Public Media.
Premieres this Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. To celebrate Women's History Month, the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra is performing two piano trios and a solo cello work by monumental maestros of composition. Our own classical Kit is here with more. And also, we're welcoming Andrew Trombley from the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra. Hello.
Good morning, Tim.
Hey, good morning,
Andrew.
Good morning, Kit. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited. I think I mentioned to you that Chaminade, Shaw, and Clark are among my favorite composers.
We were thinking
very
of you
excited.
When we programmed this.
Oh, gee, thanks, Andrew. Yeah, I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about these two piano trios from these two amazing women.
Yeah, of course. I'd be happy to do that. In trying to find programs that worked, there are so many fantastic female composers to choose from these days. That's being more and more discovered. Along with our contemporary composers, you can always celebrate Ethel Smythe. You can celebrate with Amy Beach. But the Chaminade and the Clark really had an interesting tie-in together. They're so different from each other, but they're so connected in the same way. We're going to start the program off with the Chaminade piano trio. And she was a French composer, pianist. Obviously, she was, you know, making her mark in the male-dominated field, showing early talent. She was initially rejected the opportunity to study formally at the Paris Conservatoire, but she would go on to, you know, train herself on her own through private lessons and gained a lot of fame as a pianist, having performed across the U.S. and Europe a lot of her own compositions. This particular piano trio, it's really modeled after the ideas of French Romanticism. So you're going to have a lot of essences of Fauré. You're going to have a lot of essences of Saint-Saëns. And it's really charming and beautiful and witty. And that compositional style really made, was probably one of the reasons why she was one of the first female composers to be awarded the Légion d'honneur, and which is one of France's highest honor. And while her reputation certainly faded, it did come back, you know, with resounding joy in the middle of the 20th century. And we're able to celebrate this now. And then to go down a slightly different route, but in a lot of similar ways, we have the music of Rebecca Clark. She was known primarily as a violist, and that was her mark on her industry. Obviously, composition was something she was incredibly talented at, but viola was where she probably had a lot of the most success and able to dominating her way through a male-dominated field. And she was initially known for her Viola Sonata, which is a gorgeous piece of music, a lot of influence by English folk music, which was which is important for so many composers of that time. And she used this composition, this Viola Sonata, to submit to a competition, which tied for first prize. And when she won this competition, or when she tied for first prize, rather, there was many people in the audience who would say, this Rebecca Clark surely must be a pseudonym for someone else, because there's no way that a female could write music as powerful and emotional and complex as what we just heard. And that Viola Sonata is performed all over the place today, certainly throughout universities, professionally. When I was a student at Juilliard, I must have heard my colleagues performing this thing at least, you know, 5 times a day. I'd walk down the practice rooms and I would hear the Rebecca Clark Viola Sonata. And this piano trio, which was composed only 2 years later, was submitted to the same competition and unfortunately didn't win a prize. And while you will probably hear elements of English folk music, there's a lot of emphasis on impressionism. It's a incredibly complex, gorgeous, emotionally strong piece of music that we're excited to share. Unfortunately, later in her life, she moved to the United States. She didn't quite find the level of success as a composer as she wanted, and she largely abandoned her career as a composer. But, you know, thankfully now we are celebrating this music. And it's remarkable to me that these two women were only born about 30 years apart, but their music took monumentally different paths.
Yeah, and
it's
Clark,
gonna be a blast.
You know, Clark, I heard an interview that she did in 1976 for her 90th birthday on WQXR. And she talked about that competition. And she said one of the reasons that she, you know, kind of stopped composing after her marriage, which I think she was 50 when she married, was she was one of those people that had to start thinking about her music and her composition when she woke up in the morning and just do nothing but that. And once her life got more complicated, she just felt that she couldn't give it that focus. So that's kind of our loss. But the work that she did produce is just wonderful. And you're also going to do, a piece that's so beautiful. It's almost like, I don't know, like a prayer, this Caroline Shaw solo cello work. And how did you select that? I mean, it's not, I don't think it's recorded. It's not one of her most well-known pieces, but I'm wondering how you selected that.
Sure, absolutely. Thankfully, there are some recordings of this online, so I was able to get a sneak peek. You know, I haven't heard it myself in a long time, but when I was talking to my colleague, Kirsten, we were really trying to find something that I just think could tie in the program together. And between the Chaminade and the Rebecca Clark, you know, it almost felt like, man, another piano trio just might start taking away from the Clark and the Chaminade. You know, we really want those two pieces to stand as strong as they could. So we needed something that was simpler is not the right word for it, but a little bit less complex, a little bit more ethereal. And speaking with our colleague Kirsten Germain, she had a few options, and the Caroline Shaw was one that she was very excited to present. I know Caroline Shaw's music very, very well, having performed it several times along with Room Full of Teeth. It's an incredible piece of music because rather than looking to the future or trying to make a strong mark on composition in the way that Chaminade did or Rebecca Clark did, Caroline Shaw finds a lot of influence, certainly through the voice as a singer herself, and borrows a lot from early music, from Baroque music. And this particular piece, I'm glad you mentioned prayer, has inspiration from her studies of Thomas Tallis. You know, he was an incredibly important composer in the 16th century for choral music. Certainly that 40 voice motet of his is one of the most magnificent contributions to all of music history. And so to find something that's incredibly rich, incredibly complex between the Chaminade and the Shaw, to just dial it back, something a little bit more simple and true to the roots of music, which is the human voice, the Shaw was just the perfect pick.
Yeah, and she, you know, she is so well known for combining music for voice with music for other instruments and turning voices into instruments that are beyond what we expect from the voice. But another thing that struck me was that Thomas Tallis, I mean, his work has inspired, you know, so many. I think probably Ray Vaughan Williams' theme on Thomas Tallis, Rhapsody, maybe. But maybe a little less known is Rebecca Clark also composed a piece based on a theme of Thomas Tallis. So there's a nice kind of tie in there of how, you know, over the ages, these very diverse composers have found inspiration in, you know, kind of this motherlode of early sources.
Absolutely. That early training, that early source of Western music, it was never forgotten. And, you know, for every new composer that branches out from the history, you know, we all have our roots that goes very, very deep. And we can attribute it more and more and more to what our early masters were doing. Not so much written down, but even, you know, you still have those essences of medieval music making their way through here. And everything comes from somewhere. And, you know, I do firmly believe that obviously Caroline Shaw, her contributions, her career, it's due to her talent and her amazing ability as a performer and a composer. But this wouldn't have happened without the input of Rebecca Clark, of Cécile Chaminade, and all the composers that came before those two remarkable women. We're all connected. And that's one of the great things about this program.
Well, as always, you know, you put so much thought and creativity and knowledge into creating each of your programs, and I'm looking forward to this one, which is going to be this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. But before I give the specific details on that, I know that you have two more concerts coming up in your spring series. And so we've got maybe about 4 minutes left. If you could just tell us what we have to look forward to in April and June.
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely. In April, we're going to be going back to, we're going to be doing a string quartet concert. And it's going to be all about the textures and harmonies. And we're going to be performing two pieces. So the big piece in the program will be Schubert's Rosamund Quartet. Beautiful piece of music, and we're excited to present that. We don't play Schubert often enough. And in fact, I think the last time we played Schubert was during the pandemic. We had our porch concert and we played Schubert's Quintet. That was the last time we've been able to have an opportunity to touch his music. And then before that, we'll be performing Dvorak Cypresses. This is a series of songs that he arranged for string quartet, Rosamund being borrowed from themes from incidental music. There's going to be so many similarities between a music inspired by song and then the music of a composer who only thought about song with Schubert. We'll be very happy to present those two pieces of music. And then in June, we'll be looking forward to a family-friendly concert. We're going to be performing a chamber arrangement of Peter and the Wolf. This is going to be an arrangement reduced down to 14 players. So while sadly we won't have the trio of horns who will be playing the theme of the Wolf, it'll be covered by a piano. We're excited to have an opportunity just to perform this very, very fun piece, to have a wonderful narrator presenting this concert for the children, for our families, and to really tie this all in together with SECO's commitment to education. We will be inviting 6 students of ours who have gone through competition, gone through audition, who will be performing a movement of a concerto alongside the SECO orchestra performing Peter and the Wolf. We will have 6 students, 3 on each performance, just to give them such a rare opportunity of being able to solo with an ensemble behind them. And we're excited to see how they grow and see how they do.
Well, that sounds great. So getting back to this weekend's concert, Saturday, March 22nd at 2 p.m., you're going to be at the Krauss Recital Hall. That's at DVAA and on Main Street in Narrowsburg. And then Sunday, yes, You'll be at the Landfield Avenue Synagogue on Landfield Avenue in Monticello, where you have one of your wonderful pianos. You know, both of these concerts, one of my things said that's at 3 p.m. and something else said 5. So is it at 3? Is that correct?
It's at 3 p.m. on Sunday.
Okay.
And Saturday is presented as part of DBAA's Salon Series, which I always have to, you know, help promote them as well. They've been such good friends of ours, and their Salon Series has such interesting programming going on. Both concerts are completely free to attend. So in addition to ours, I hope, you know, all of our listeners try to check out as much of the Salon Series as possible. And yeah, and being back at Landfield, it was a beautiful space for a concert last week. We are absolutely in love with that Mason Hamlin. It'll be our second performance on it. And it's just been such a joy to discover what this instrument can do.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You know, looking forward to the concert and everything that you do for Sullivan County.
Thank you so much, Kit. We really appreciate the support. I mean, always love talking to you.
Same here.
Thanks, okay. Andrew. And the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra website is currently, as they say, being composed. I love a good pun. So you can get information about the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra on their social media, SCOO Players on Facebook and Instagram. Classical Kit, good to have you back. And it looks like it's going to be a busy classical music season.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here. Well, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, program note, for over 4 decades, This Old House has been America's go-to source for expert advice on home improvement. And now, starting Sunday, Radio Chatskill is bringing that staple of home improvement to the airwaves with This Old House Radio Hour, starting at 7 a.m. every Sunday. Now you can tune in for a weekly hour-long dive into the spirit of do-it-yourself culture, inspiring your skills and allowing you to take on some projects big and small. That's This Old House Radio Hour, starting Sunday at 7. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering 4 counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we profile Myra Melford, a multidimensional pianist and composer. From big band to solo, trio to quintet, Any setting is fair game for this master improviser.
There are a lot of different strains of music in there, but they're all kind of brought together through my own sensibility of how these things should come together.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me Sunday at 8 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, it's the first day of spring, but we're in for some cooler weather coming up. Cloudy skies this afternoon, giving way to a few showers later on, high 54. Rain mixing with snow overnight tonight with a low of 28. Some winds gusting up to 25 miles an hour. It could occasionally gust over 40 miles an hour. Cloudy, windy continued tomorrow with those gusts up to 40 miles an hour again, high 41. And then for the weekend, it looks like it's going to be a little bit cloudy and perhaps snow.